Greetings from Podcastville. It's Monday, the 25th of November. Get your shit together. The Church of What's Happening Now is brought to you by MyBookie. Listen, attention, attention. Past, present, and future MyBookie players. This Thanksgiving Day, you could get in a game risk-free. If the Pilgrims can sail to America, you could take a chance on the Bears-Lions game. Either way, you're not losing... Excuse me, Gittes. Either way, you're not losing Gittes. This Thanksgiving Day only, choose a team against the spread up to $250. If you win, you got some cash for the holidays. And if you lose, you also win because my bookie will give you your money back. Let me repeat, that's a guaranteed deposit match and risk-free bet for Thanksgiving only. So if you're a true football fan, I mean a real motherfucking football fan, you don't want to let this opportunity pass you by. Stop waiting in the sidelines. Stop sitting there like a fucking mutt. This is the prime time to make money. Now you got this game, and then next week is bowl season. You got basketball. You got college basketball. You got NBA action. You got everything coming at you. And the most importantly is you got mybookie.ag. So go to mybookie.ag. Use promo code CHURCH, C-H-U-R-C-H, and get in on the fucking action this year. You play, you win, you get paid. The Church is also brought to you by My Tushy. Listen, I've been working on My Tushy for 3 years. Lee still has his. I still have mine. They're fucking tremendous. Do you understand me? Why walk around with that stinky fucking asshole on Thanksgiving? This is the time of the year that you want to feel good about yourself. It starts from within, from your asshole, your nutsack. All that type of shit. But start with Tushy. You're like, why, Joey? Go to Hello Tushy right now and look at the great selection of bidets they got starting at $69. They even come with a fucking guarantee, but there's no guarantee. Let me tell you what the guarantee is. Lee and Joey have had one for the last fucking 3 years, and they still work, and they haven't broken. So if our fat asses haven't fucked it up, what is your skinny little bony stinky ass waiting for? Go to HelloTushy.com right now. Press in Church and get 10% off your order. The Church is also brought to you by CBDLion.com. Listen, this last week, I injured myself really fucking bad. And the reason why it was easy for me to sleep at night was because CBDLion.com. I took the tincture and I rubbed it on my thigh 3-4 fucking times a day. They got a rollerball now. It comes with like a eucalyptus flavor to it, like a mint. You roll it on the back of your fucking leg. Listen. CBD Lion ain't stopping. They take care of you with the fucking vapor pens, no E, no vitamin E, accelerate in there, whatever the fucking chemical is that's making kids cough their lungs out. They got the shatter. They got the tincture. They got the raspberry fucking gummies. They got the roll-on. CBDLion.com. Go look at the third-party test results yourself online. Go to CBDLion.com right now. Press in Church and get 20% off your first order, all right? Who takes care of your Thanksgiving week? Nobody. Kick this fucking mule, Lee.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, shit.
Yo, Black,
Monday
time,
morning,
man.
The right motherfucking
it's
way.
Time, it's time, man.
Right. Uncle Joey.
Yeah. Yeah.
Donnell Rollins.
Straight out the fucking dungeons of rap.
The Christ
well,
Killer.
Niggas don't make it back.
What? Get ready to stab a motherfucker. It's Monday, bitches.
Rappers are monkey flipping with the funky rhythm. I be kicking, musician, inflicting composition of pain. I'm like Scarface sniffing cocaine. Holding M16. See, with the pen, I'm extreme. Now, bullet holes left in my peacoats. I'm suited up with street clothes. Hand me a 9 and out the
peak. What's happening, you bad motherfuckers? Thanksgiving week. Just think 2,000 years ago, right now, today. Pilgrims were stabbing Indians in the heart with pencils and shit, trying to take their motherfucking corn and shit. So when you're eating your little fucking turkey, don't forget about nothing. Donnell, talk to me, baby. What's happening?
I celebrate every holiday. I know you just dismissed that evil holiday of Thanksgiving and how it started, but me growing up, I liked any holiday that you didn't have to go to school for.
Me too.
Yeah. Chris, I didn't know who the fuck Christopher Columbus was.
You didn't give a fuck.
George Washington, President's Day, Christopher Columbus, any day. And a lot of those holidays was all after white people, and no disrespect to the black community, but I was so happy those white people was able to give me a day and I didn't have to go to school.
Remember when it used to be Lincoln and Washington Day? You had off the 12th and the 19th.
Yeah.
You had off two Mondays in a row. Then they got hip to it and they cut us down to President's Day.
President's Day, they put everybody in.
Motherfuckers.
And then when Barack got elected, they got rid of the holiday altogether.
Yeah. No, and then they got rid of Columbus Day, which I knew was going to be backfire.
Right.
Because that means they're going to start changing motherfuckers' days all the time.
Oh, yeah, Columbus Day. That's
Once you fuck with Columbus, now they want to change Halloween.
What are they going to change Halloween
Saturday, to? Saturday. The last Saturday of the month so the kids don't eat sugar during the week.
Is that like some legislation or something?
No, that's fucking Gentiles.
Okay. I'm like, who makes up this shit?
Yeah, so they always want to change some shit. But, man, let me tell you something.
Huh?
For 20 fucking years, I've been watching you. And I'm like, I wonder what street in Harlem he's from.
Me?
Yeah, I always thought you were from fucking Harlem.
Nah, Brooklyn.
And then the other day, you're from Brooklyn.
Well, not, well... Most of, I'm originally from Washington, D.C., by the way, Alexandria.
Virginia, some
yeah,
shit.
Yeah, but right. My, for the most part, I was when I started, 6 months into it, I broke out of D.C., and I moved to New York. So I consider that my second home. I consider that's the home of my career, but that's my second home in life.
What year did you start comedy at?
It probably was like 96, 97.
No shit.
Yeah, it was right when black comedy was on fire.
Fire. And yeah. What made you, did you think about it?
I never thought about doing comedy, but I was always the funniest dude in the room. You know, and I've told this story before. I was in the military. I was a police officer in the military, and I got out of the military and I was waiting to be a DC police officer, and I used to work for this grocery chain. I was head of security, and it was a guy that used to work for Hostess Cupcake Company. And he had a day job. He didn't quit his day job. He was hostess dude in the daytime and then a comedian at night. And he would give out free passes to get people to go. And I used to go with a lot of people I worked with, and I started heckling. I was heckling people. I was heckling the shit out of people. I mean, I was heckling where pros was coming up to me saying, yo, chill, man. I'm trying to work on this set for so. I was like, man, fuck out of here. You do your job, I'm going to do my job. And I did that so long that people started to come to the comedy club to hear me heckle. And I was so naive because I went to the club owner and I was like, look, I didn't increase y'all business by 30%. I tried to get a door deal as a heckler. Yo, I was like, man, look at the numbers that I'm bringing in here. They looked at me like, what the fuck are you talking about?
What club was this?
This was Comedy Connection to Greenbelt.
No shit.
And it was like, and at this time in the 90s or late 90s, it was like black comedy was It was popping so hard that it wasn't comedy clubs, but it'd be like a pizza shop that, you know, like they usually have slow business on a Monday or a Tuesday. They would start a night, and then they was finding out that, you know, these little small comedy hubs turned into comedy clubs. Monique, she flipped a restaurant in Baltimore when she first started from a struggling restaurant. She had a comedy night on a Thursday, and it was doing so well. Her door was doing great. The food was doing great. Everything was doing great. Business wasn't doing well on the weekends, and she turned it over and flipped it where she caught the lease, and she turned it to one of the a black comedy club in Baltimore. And that's how the Comedy Connection at Greenbelt, it was a spot that the need for black comedy was so overwhelming that anybody could just open up and say, you know, we got black comedy, we got Def Jam comedy, you know? So I went on, they wanted me to shut the fuck up. I didn't shut the fuck up. And one day they say, would you go on? And I was like, I like it on this side of it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, no, I don't want that pressure. And I didn't do it that week. And then I went and I did that week. I went and wrote what I thought was a half hour worth of material. You know, when you first start, you think, you look at a sit, you're like, oh, that's going to get me a minute. That's going to get a minute. And that ain't got nothing to do with nobody laughing at the shit. You being nervous and forgetting the shit. And I practiced what I thought I was going to have a set. And a week after that, I went on stage. I caught a standing ovation, first time I ever touched the mic. And I'm sure part of it was, it wasn't just that I was super funny, but because I had such a history in that club, people were really rooting for me. They wanted me to graduate from being a heckler, and the only thing next to do is to go on stage. And that day, I never looked back. I was like, this fuck being a cop, I'm doing this shit. That's how it started.
Now, how long were you in the service for?
4 years.
And you were stationed in Korea?
I was stationed in Kunsan, Korea.
What'd you think?
I loved it. When I went in the military when I was 17, so my mother actually had to sign parental consent to fight for my country. And for me, it was a good transition because I'd never been on an airplane. I'd never been outside of the Alexandria area. Culturally, it was great. You know, for me, not really being trained in anything or have any skills. And for most black people, that's a good option to just being a street person or going to jail. You know what I'm saying? Probably first time some people get credit cards, first time you see anything. So that experience of me leaving home was incredible. I met some good friends in basic training, met some good friends in tech school. My first duty station was Kunsan, Korea. I met some people that I still consider to be my closest friends for years. I met some good people. And I got to go to a place and learn a whole different culture, a whole way of life, a whole different how people look at people. And it kind of opened me up to look at the world different from that person that would have just been, you know, on a corner talking shit, rolling dice and smoking weed and shit.
Why didn't you stay in?
I didn't stay in because I had a discipline problem, and it wasn't enough to, I would have kept getting in trouble. I wasn't built for it. 4 years was good for me. Like, I had an issue with respect, I guess. I wasn't a bad...
you didn't like how you were spoken to?
I just didn't like anybody just because you outranked me being able to say any fucking
thing.
Talk to
you the way they want to.
And then some people like was abusive with it. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, I would rather you talk to me like a man first, but not like somebody that, you know, that works for him, you know? And I just, it was a good transition for me not doing anything in my life with finding something to do. And it was just time for me to move on. You know, I had some good experience and I met some good people, but I wasn't built to be running out of bunkers and doing. In fact, if I had to protect this country, a lot of people would have got killed. So, we used to do exercises where you simulate war. So you simulate like what would happen if you under attack by, you know, North Korea, or whatever. And when you get killed, they come and pick you up in this van or this truck, this Deuce. I think it's called a Deuce, and they take you to the gym. And when you get to the gym, while you're there, you get to play basketball, right? So, man, it wasn't no black people in that battleground, son. It was all white people with camouflage makeup all on their face, hiding behind trees and shit. Black dudes in the gym hitting three-pointers, man. We was like, fuck that war. So I wasn't, I served my country, but I wasn't like super patriotic, like, but you know, I did it.
At 56, you know, it's one of my biggest regrets.
Not going into the military?
Yeah.
Why?
It was my mother's dream.
So you from military?
No, but she felt she was Cuban, and she felt that the United States gave her a chance and took her in, that the least she could do is offer her son to fight for this country. So she used to never shut the fuck up about it.
Really?
Yeah, she never used to.
That's a dope story.
But what's really crazy to me is, you know, okay, you come to me and you go, Joey, my name is Donnell. I'm thinking of doing stand-up. I go, Donnell, you know, what are you doing for work? I work at Ralph's. I stuff shelves. I make 18 an hour. I get benefits. I go, well, listen, we're going to do a plan. We're going to get you some open mics, blah, 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 blah.
Right.
And then you're going to transition. You're going to look at me and say, cut it out, Negro.
Right.
How much am I going to make and how long is it going to take?
Exactly.
And I'm going to look at you and say, 10 years.
Right.
To be conservative. Let's go for 10 years before you make a dime.
That's
nine out of 10 motherfuckers will go, 10 years? I ain't got time for you.
Yeah.
And then one day you find yourself, you're 34 years old, and you go, fuck.
I should have.
If I would have got into that when I was, and what am I done with my life?
But you know, but you look how you flip it. It happens for a reason.
No, and I get it. But man, the idea of walking out of a motherfucker when you're 38, full retirement benefits.
You know, it's so funny you say that, Joey, because I actually have that. Sometimes I have that. I dream about that thought.
I dream. That's my dream.
And I was like, it's because I went in when I was 17. And I look at it, that's the one thing, but it's a difference from going from that 4 to that 20.
Right, yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
You know it's what I'm saying? We're just talking here.
We're just talking. Like that 4,
we're just talking.
I'm looking at 16 plus, and I'm looking at a military that always yelling at me, right? Your blatant disregard for established military policies. That's every day. I'm getting letter of reprimands. Even I was mischievous. I got in a little trouble, but the military, they want you to be for the most part, squeaky clean. And even if you're not, it's so much harder to get stripes. It's so much harder to get the accolades you need. And I'm the same way. I thought, like you thought, I thought about that 20-year joint, but that 4-1 was such a grind for me, I couldn't go to the next 16.
Man.
But I respect the people that do it. And even though I meet people, they're like, man, I was in the military. I'm like, man, think our business, that would, might not have been the path of life. 17 go in, 20 years later, get out, 38. You really, especially Black Don't Crack, I really could have started a stand-up career then.
Getting $7,000 a month,
yep,
with the best insurance in the world.
Yep.
You know, all you got to do is go down there and they'll give you a pair of teeth right there.
Right.
You know.
I mean, anything.
You know, I mean, you have to just think about it.
Yeah.
And a lot of young kids listen to these podcasts.
Right.
And you really have to explain to them that. Let me tell you something, man. I'm 56. I still remember being 36.
Right.
That 20 went by quick in the motherfucker.
They don't see it now.
And I starved, and I slept on couches, you know, and I took Greyhound buses.
All of that.
What's the difference? The only thing I didn't do was get shot at by right. some fucking dude with a towel or threw fucking a grenade at me.
But
in my heart, I felt like it.
Right.
When you're fucking at a Greyhound station with $4 in your pocket.
Man, I did. When I found my love for comedy, I was like, this is what I'm going to be doing for the rest of my life. And I had a pretty decent job. The job I had, benefits, everything you're talking about. And you know, like your come up and my come up not too far, like not far apart in a sense of the first thing you want to do is be able to provide for yourself. First thing you want to do, like you said, benefits, and let me get some regular shit. And as square as our lifestyle, as square as I might think, and I know probably, and like as you got old, you like, you know, could I have been that square motherfucker? You know what I'm saying? Could I have been that? And that's not a bad life at all. And for a lot of people, the military, that's what it provided. It provided that transition for you to have a decent life. 20 years, I was like, if I started, like I said, 20 years ago, 38, started this all over, you know, you could think that would have been a perfect situation. But then, you know, everything happens in its due time. And I was on the buses. When I moved from D.C. to New York, I moved to D.C. to New York with $35 in my pocket. I had my military duffel bag and an alarm clock. And my man, Royale Watkins had already done Def Comedy Jam. So he was under Russell Simmons' umbrella, managed by Rush Communications, Bob Sumner.
What year is this?
This was like 97, 98.
Okay.
So he already got it popping. Like for DC comic to hear about another comic moving to New York, because everybody talked that shit. And everybody always have an excuse. I need to save up amount of money and then I'm going to go up there.
Right.
You make a million excuses. You know, you're making a million excuses. Oh, I got to do this. I got to get my set together. No, motherfucker, you got to get on that bus.
Let's get on that bus.
And I know he was trying to punk me. Every time I see him, this nigga was happy as shit. He getting development deals and everything. He was like, yo, come up to New York. And one day I called him. I said, man, I'm moving to New York. He was like, when? I said, Friday, motherfucker. And I went on that, got down Peter Pan, the Peter Pan Trailway. At that time, for me, it was $19. And it was, when I first went to New York, I wasn't getting no stage time. So, you know, when you leave a certain place, your money, you like a popular name in D.C. So I was still a part of the D.C. scene, still doing the cabaret. So when I was broke, I would dip down to D.C. to do a show for like $500 with $20 in my pocket, knowing I had to go over there, snatch that money up, and then come back and keep on grinding until people start to take notice. And then I started to be able to do the same hustle in New York.
So you moved to Brooklyn?
I moved to Brooklyn. Brooklyn was the first borough I moved to.
What's the first comedy club you went into?
First comedy
Pips?
Club? No, it wasn't Pips. It was like, I was still from the Black Circuit. So I didn't even really go to, when I first moved to New York, I didn't go to comedy clubs. I went to Black Nights, like Boston Comedy Club. Was pretty
Fourth
much of a
Street,
mainstream.
Right,
the Comedy Cellar was mainstream. Catch a Rising Star was mainstream. And out of all the comics in New York, it was probably 3 or 4% of the Black comics working in mainstream rooms. You just couldn't get in. And the only way you could get in, you know, you had to be first vouched by somebody else, you know, but waiting to get past and all that, it was just comedy nights. You like Def Comedy now. jam nights, comedy explosion nights. So those are the stages that I performed in. First mainstream comedy club I went into was the Boston Comedy Club, and that was because it was a black night on Sunday. And when I moved, and I was happy with just doing the black circuit because you could make an honest living. It was like so many rooms that were open. Like, you could make a grand a week, you know, a grand. You could make it like you had a spot. You had like six or seven spots. You're doing $1.25 each joint. You could make a grand a week for a comic that's not married, don't have no responsibilities, and rooming with somebody. That was decent. And that was probably one of the reasons why a lot of black comics had an issue with crossing over or doing mainstream, because they got so comfortable with making a decent living in the black circuit, but not understanding that wasn't the future. You know what I'm saying? That was temporary.
One of the things that I got on stage in 91. I didn't get serious till 93. And a young brother saw me in Denver. I was in Denver. His name is Kwame. And I think about him a lot because I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for him. He threw me into a den of thieves.
Yeah.
He had a black man on East Colfax.
And you went up?
And this is when East Colfax was East Colfax.
Right. Like
hookers, syringes, crack pipes. And it was called, you know, Black Explosion on Sunday nights.
Right.
And he would book comedians to fly in. Uh-huh. And I got to meet, which these relationships are still intact. This is 94.
Right.
I got to meet DL, Bernie.
They were smoking back then.
Cedric Young.
Yeah.
Steve Harvey, you know. I'm sure I met other ones I don't remember, but.
It was a black night.
It was a black night.
Right.
And they only allowed two white comics that were allowed in there.
Rich Voss, who are you?
this is Denver.
Okay.
So it was me and a white dude that you guys know. His name is Dr. Kevin Fitzgerald. He's a veterinarian.
Really?
On Animal Planet. He's a big white dude.
I mean.
And he saves animals and stuff. He's a stand-up.
Oh, yeah?
In real life. So, like, Kwame was a solid brother.
Right.
He would go, bro, you know, everybody's welcome.
Right.
But not everybody was welcome, because you go down and they throw shit at you.
Man, I know those rooms.
So I figured out that for me to go up on stage, I had to come out dancing first.
Right.
So I put on like SWV and I come out dancing to SWV. And then I'd have to attack them.
Oh, yeah.
This is, you know, 2 years into comedy.
Yeah.
I had to jump into them. Like, look at this fucking Barry White looking motherfucker. To let them know, look at this guy, looks like Archie Bell without the drills.
You pop them shots right off the gate.
You have to attack them.
Yeah.
And I would have three jokes. But the first 10 minutes was, look at this,
but I'm going to tell you one thing. Even with that said, but when you got them, how good did it feel ripping it?
I used to remember getting off stage. And listen, I was doing comedy 3 years. Donnell, I can tell you whatever the fuck you want me to tell you. I was eating a bag of dicks.
Oh, really?
But for 7 minutes, I was making my soul stronger.
Yeah.
Because not too many people would do that. Not too many people would go into an African-American room, never mind go there to bomb and be up first.
I'm going to tell you, I saw the first time, and you 100% right, because when I started Comedy Connection Greenbelt, Def Jam was hot. So like you said, all those names you named, Bernie Mac, D.A., Chris Tucker, Eddie Griffin, Chucky Ducky. I mean, so many. It was so many. You were just black comic. And the first time I ever saw a white dude go into this room and just straight demolish it, it was Rich Voss.
Yes, that's what.
Man, let me tell you. I said, this motherfucker had a ponytail back then, sir. And I was saying, he was going so hard at these brothers, I was like, oh, he about to get shot.
But
the thing about it was, he didn't back down. He was like, bam, bam, bam. Rich Voss was the first white guy on Def Comedy Jam.
Yes, and BET also.
And I always tell, whenever I run into him, I was like, man, I've never seen a white dude with a ponytail go into a black room like that and just eat him up. But the love you got, it was a handful of comics like that. DC Benny out of DC, he was one of the dudes that worked. Yeah, Puerto Rican.
Good dude.
Puerto Rican, one of them whites, right? and Bill Burr. Bill Burr, when he first moved to Boston, Bill Burr was heavy on the black circuit. And then, you know, he did Madison Square Garden. We've had the black community haven't seen him since. But Bill was one of those dudes that would go eat up any room, black room, white room. And I tell, like I mentor, and I sometimes, you know, I got all types of comic friends, whatever. And more so when, like, with my white comic friends, when they like tell him, say, like, well, it's hard for me to get stage time and stuff, I was like, you know what you should start doing? I said, start doing black rooms. And they look at me like, oh. I'm like, why? I say, because most black rooms are gonna put you on just to see you fail. And even if that's how you get on stage, at least you get on stage. And then when you get on stage, you flip it and show them something
and
different.
You figure it out.
You know what I'm saying? You figure it out.
You figure it out.
Like we so used to being in an environment where it's comfortable and easy. And following back, like when you said the first room I went, the first places I performed outside of the black room, it was a poetry scene was really hot in Brooklyn at the time. They had this spot called Brooklyn Moon Cafe. And it was when poetry was like really popping, where they was doing the snaps and shit. And dudes was getting pussy just by, you know, burning the right incense, drinking the right tea, and just telling the bitch, I love your energy. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm connected to your soul. They was fucking them herbal chicks in the bathroom the same way the pimps was doing this. I'm into your soul, my sister. And the longer you say sister, that's the longer you be in the fuck. You know what I'm saying? Like, oh my God, did you see Mr. Knowledge? And I when I couldn't get on the stage, so I was like, man, I got to perform somewhere. And I would go because that shit used to be so boring. But this spot was so hot. Like, Mos Def used to go there. Fucking Talib used to go there. Erykah Badu used to go there when she was not Erykah Badu. Like, literally, like, she's go to this spot, like, moving to Brooklyn, like being there for, like, 3 weeks. And it's just a hot spot. And I was like, man, this shit is so dry. They could use some jokes. And I felt like the fish out of wood. I was like, yo, can I get up there? He was like, you a poet? They were like, you a poet? And I'm like, yeah. And I'll go up there and be like, I want to say. And then I'll go into a set. And I started getting popular in the poetry scene. I was like, wait a minute, if I can't get on stage, these poetry spots be so dead and dry, I could be known as a comedian to come shake up the poetry scene.
That's what I would do also.
And that's what I was like, I don't know. We think a lot in terms of how you get better, you know what I'm saying? And always sharpen the sword. You know, at your age and at my age, you know, for this is not being cocky or anything, but we've been holding our weight for a long time. Through types of technologies, man. VHS, beta. We remember all of that shit. Motherfucker. VHS, beta, CD, CD-ROM, Blu-ray, Lynx. That's a lot of motherfucking years of technology, son. That's a lot of, and when I say that, because these motherfuckers like to talk a lot of shit, hey, old man, all that type of shit. But see how long a motherfucker can hold their weight. And not just pity party, like, yeah, I saw him on so-and-so, I gave him a couple chuckles. I'm talking about, no, motherfucker, pound for pound, let's go. And they don't do that no more. They don't do... The United States, you got to be there every night, but you got to stay sharp. You got to get on it if you're a comedy fiend, and that's what I am.
When your mind switches into that comedy fiend mode where life isn't even life anymore, your whole life is writing, watching, or getting on stage.
Right.
There's a part of your career where, for me, it was the 3-year mark.
Uh-huh.
Where for 3 years, I didn't know what was popular on TV. I didn't know anything.
He was in it.
I rented the BET Comedy All-Star tape with Martin doing the warm-up with Joe Torre.
Uh-huh.
And I rented Rodney Dangerfield's Young Comedian Special with Dice and Bill Hicks. And if I wasn't on stage writing, I was watching those two things.
That nut, I know.
Studying. Moves, hand gestures.
Man,
the young brother from New York that was killing in New York when you went back in 94? He's still around.
Who?
Good looking young brother.
Bill Bellamy. Yeah.
He was like the king of New York.
Man, when let me
I was
tell you, Bill Bellamy, it's one of the reasons he endorsed me to be on Def Jam when I tricked Bob Sumner into taking a phone call from me. I called up there. I had Def Jam's office number, and I was like, man, I need an audition. I can't call up there and say, what is the procedures, or do I send a tape? I said, I got to call up there and act like I already know these motherfuckers. I said, yo, this Donnie, where Bob at? Put him on the phone. the receptionist was like, who is it? I said, never mind. Look, tell Bob. She was like, wait. She put him on the phone. Who is it? Donnell. I tricked your receptionist. Blah, 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 blah. I had an open for a lot of the guys that under your management or whatever. I just want a shot. And he said, can you come this Thursday? I said, I'm working this Thursday. He said, nigga, you got a job. How you a real comedian? You got a job. But I'm sure because, and I had worked after that, I had worked with Bill Bellamy. And Bill Bellamy was the one that dropped the seed in Bob Sumner's ear, up in his brain, for him to let me get an audition.
And then you got on Def Jam.
I got on
Def
Jam.
What year was this?
This was like 98. I was doing comedy for 6 months when I made Def Jam.
And did your life change?
It didn't change. It didn't change. The reason why it didn't change, at that time for Def Jam, you for your life to change, you had to have an explosive set. Now, you could have a set where you could make some money for a couple years because it was such a demand for black comedy that everybody was doing rooms. And the biggest credit for a black comedian was Def Comedy Jam. And you know what I'm saying? Like, you didn't even have to be the baddest motherfucker. You just had to be on Def Jam. The promoter could be like, just from Def Comedy Jam. The brand sold itself. Hopefully you get one of the marquee people, but if not, you're still getting somebody from Def Jam. So with me, I was really young. When I made it, I made it Def Jam. I was doing comedy for 6 months, and I taped Def Jam. I was doing comedy for 11 months. I was green. I didn't know nothing about those bright lights or whatever. I told a story about this fat kid taking my bike when I was a kid. It was my signature bit in D.C. It was a bit where it was animated. I acted out. But I'll be honest, my set wasn't as explosive. To keep it real, I thank Michael Blackson for me even making the cut. Because when you tape Def Jam, it's four comics that tape. One person always going to get cut. Everybody didn't make it. One person. And whoever had not the wackest, but the least funny, they was going to get cut. And that, and I'll be honest, it was me, hang with Steve Harvey. My brain is catching a fart now. J. Anthony Brown, some more. This guy named Wyatt. J. Anthony Brown, some more. Wyatt, me. It was four or five tapes. Me, Michael Blackson, and my set was just okay. Michael Blackson destroyed the room. Michael Blackson was ripping this room, just demolishing this room. It's going crazy. And at the end of his set, he already damn it in the middle of a standing up. And he went to Africa, you motherfuckers. You want to have Africa, you know what that mean? And then everybody's like, what? He said, I have a big dick. Everybody's like, And they was like, you want to see my dick? They was like, yeah. And they thought, and then this motherfucker pulled out a prosthetic dick. About 5 feet long, right? 5 feet long, big black veiny, a big ass horse dick, and he started waving around, and it ripped the room. But Def Jam was coming down under a lot of flack because they was like, "All right, this shit is getting too crazy." You know what I'm saying? It's like, come on, now y'all pulling out big ass dicks. How far are we gonna take a dick joke? And Mike said, "This far, right?" And that Mike got cut off of it. Because his set was, he could have closed. He got cut because of that, and it gave me the opportunity to be on the show. But it didn't, what it did for me is it started, I could have other conversations with people, you know, promoters and different shit. I'm still doing a chilling circuit, but it's like, oh, shit, it's a reference point. You know what I'm saying? It's like, oh, that is the guy from Def Jam. And, like, back then, they knew you by a joke you told. You know what I'm saying? It's like, Royale. He did this joke where he said, I ain't scared of you. I'm not. He said, you know, y'all not going to make me nervous tonight. And then he takes his coat off and turns around and put on the mic stand. And he's got a gun in his backside. So they knew him as the dude with the gun in the back. You know, at the time, Chris Tucker was known as the pissed off man. Because when Chris Tucker made it, when Chris Tucker was on Def Jam, he got seen by Bob Sumner. Bob Sumner was a talent coordinator. I don't know if you know, but they had a really popular black a comedy competition called the Bay Area Black. It was over in Oakland. It was ran for like 15 or 20 years. If I'm not mistaken.
What's his name? Won it a couple times.
Who?
Mr. Cooper.
Yep. Hanging exactly. With
Mr. Cooper.
Yep. That launched him.
Yes.
That launched him. That was the direct. Because I think, if I'm not mistaken, Marcus Keene, who used to manage Jamie, I think he was affiliated with some kind of way. But whatever it was, when it came to black comedy, that's where you went. And Chris Tucker was a part of that. that competition. And Chris Tucker, he didn't win the competition. I think he came in like second. And at the time, Chris Tucker had like 6 minutes.
That's it.
That's it. But you know, in this business, sometimes people think you got an hour and a half. Sometimes all you need is 3 minutes of the right shit, and it's gone.
It's gone.
He had the look. He had the energy. You know what I'm saying? He was energetic. He was happy. He was friendly. And he just had this energy. He had 6 minutes, and that's all he needed. And it was like, and this was Def Jam. Def Jam was making people overnight stars on one tape. And that's how powerful the show was. The show came on at 12 o'clock Friday nights, and you planned your evening or whatever you were going to do. It happened after Def Jam came off. And I remember Chris Tucker, and I've said this on different platforms, when Chris Tucker came off and said, "Pissed off, man." You know, some people just got it. Just, he said, "Pissed off, man." He said, "I'm so broke, if a nigga robbed me, it'd just be practice." And he did some shit, and it was pow, pow, Bernie Mac. "I ain't scared of you motherfuckers." Pow, Adele Gibbons. "These big lips and your little dick would be like giving a whale a Tic Tac." Pow. It got so bad, Joey, that motherfuckers was like writing catchphrases. They were like, "Oh, if I get to this, shuck it, duck it, quack, quack." Something that people could remember you from, and people was eating off of that.
I can still see Joe Torre and recite his routine.
Yeah. Joe Torre was one of those. He was a breakaway.
Martin Lawrence, I could recite his routine. There was a bit he had that I loved.
Martin. It was just, Martin was, man, it was just such a lot of people, I don't know if they know the story, but Martin wasn't the first option for Def Comedy Jam. It was Robin Harris.
One of the funniest men.
Funny motherfuckers, and a good, stock joke, and a good, crowd.
Good motherfucker.
You could feel it. But, you know, in his passing, they was looking for, that was Robin Harris' show. He passed, Martin was bubbling, and next thing you know, that was it. And like, and I think the show, Def Jam, kind of suffered when Martin left, because he just stamped it so much as, when you heard Def Jam, you heard of Martin Lawrence. And no disrespect to Joe Torre or all the other attempts they made, but Martin was just so likable. You know what I'm saying? He was so likable. And he had that gift to be able to be insulted without being offensive. You know what I'm saying? Like, he could get you right there, like, "Oh, you know, I'm fucking with you, what up?" And then he'd bring you right back. And he, man, Martin did so much. Martin, Russell Simmons, and Stan Latham and Bob Sumner did so much for black comedy, man. They created a platform when it didn't exist, when all you had was late, like David Letterman. You know, you had those late night circuits and late night shows, but how often did you see a black person on those? You hardly ever did. And they found that need and desire, and they filled it and made some careers, man. Really, that show really made some careers.
From 95 to 2000,
uh-huh,
black comedy was so huge. No matter what town you went to, what club you went to, they had one night a week dedicated. They, you know, Black Sunday, Black Thunder. And they always flew two guys in, always sold out two shows. But one of the busiest African-American shows I ever saw in my life was D. Ray Davis in Chicago on Sunday night.
He had a Sunday night?
Four shows.
And that was his night?
He would walk out of there with 30 G's. And
let me tell you something,
minutes.
Man. This is that was the hustle I had. Like,
He didn't even need to leave town.
Every
he was
city.
$100,000 one night a month in Chicago.
How many people would show up?
Like
1,200 for the night.
But the thing, Joey, that was piece. Like, that was, damn. And on the urban scene, that was the hustle,
that
bro.
That was the hustle.
The hustle, like everybody, and then hustle went to different cities. And then we created, like, the black circuit, we created our own tours, but we called them runs. You know what I'm saying? You knew, like, D-Ray would have a night, and then somebody else would
What's
have a
the
night.
Dude in South Florida? Good dude. Glasses, been there since.
Marvin Dixon is another example. You know, I had a room in Brooklyn, New York. It was called Poke Knockers, right? It was called Poke Knockers, and it was just like this West Indian restaurant. And we would do 4,000 at the door, and then food and drinks would do like 10,000-12,000. This was on a Monday night. And like you said, like the smart comics, the ones, the entrepreneurs, and you can see how D-Ray's become so successful. Like, we had, like, the dope dudes in the city, you had a night, that you could eat off of. I was a struggling comic for me to have one night where I could pay my rent. I didn't have a lot of bills, but that's when, you know, when you adapt. D-Ray did it. D-Ray did it. Bernie Mac, before Bernie Mac blew up on Def Jam, he had the Cotton Club.
Down in Chicago.
Yeah, they had a Cotton
Club. And I heard stories about
But the only thing, about it, Joy, was like with these pop-up black shows or whatever, and then like people started like looking down certain clubs and stuff, they would look down on black comedy. You know, they would just lump anybody. If you just said, motherfucker, you'd be like, oh, he's one of Def Jam acts. You know what I'm saying? And then a lot of people didn't respect some of the stand-ups from there. So now you got that. It's only going to last for a certain amount of time. You got that certain type of money. But now you don't have to do mainstream. But, you know, the more people that know about you, the more opportunity. It's not too many black comics that have built a very, very successful career just off the black audience.
What do we have in L.A. now? We have Chocolate Sunday.
Chocolate Sundays.
We have D-Ray Monday.
D-Ray Monday.
Then they made it. They went small with it at the Comedy Store. Thursday night.
Thursday.
Upstairs.
Upstairs. Michelle Murdoch.
Now, when I got to this town, if you wanted an agent, a manager, a movie, you had to be at one of those nights.
Right.
I wasn't a big Chocolate Thunder guy. I did it one time and bombed, and the guy didn't like me.
Pookie?
The checkup. This, I'm talking 98.
Okay, cool. I don't even know who's
in it. This is when.
Was Chris Spencer the host? Who was hosted there?
Chris Spencer, you're right, and Weber used to go there. Chris Weber would go in there with the black model.
Yo, Chris Weber was I think he wanted to be a stand-up because when he was with the Wizards, he used to always be at the comedy spots, man.
So I used to go to that one.
Joe Torre, too. Joe Torre had Fat Tuesdays.
From Indianapolis.
Guy Torre had Fat Tuesdays.
Guy and Joe had, and they had a partner. Solid brother out of what I still ask about him, Kansas City. He threw me up on there, you know, and that was $35 in those days. Right. People don't know it. $35 on a Tuesday?
What?
Shit.
Man, when I was in New York, man, go ahead. I'm sorry.
And they would have ribs and shit. They would get it catered from.
And you got to eat free?
And you got to eat free and shit.
Motherfuckers will know about that. And two drink tickets?
And two drink tickets? Shit.
Two drink tickets and you can walk with your 30? You had some of them bullshit motherfuckers be like, they give you $30, like the drink, $15. Motherfucker, give me that drink, leave me the fuck alone.
And the Improv had Monday night, and that was officially, first of all, Joe Torre's room on Tuesdays was where they went to see Chris Spencer for American History X.
Oh, yeah?
But they gave it to Guy Torre.
I didn't know that story.
And then they went to see Joe Torre for Fifth Dimension.
And they gave it to guy?
Chris Tucker.
Yeah. They'd be like, stop coming to my motherfucking shows.
I still remember being a telemarketer at the store, and the main room seats 450 people, and they would get 100 industry people. Real. Not
real, real. Oh, yeah, change.
I'm talking Paramount.
The ones when you see the motherfucker write on a piece of paper, be like, oh, I got it.
But Monday night at the Improv was the night. That was
it's hot night. Spike Davis. Spike Davis started that.
This is 98. This is when it was Ariel Spears and Corey Miller, Zoo.
Oh, yeah. Zoo's fire.
Zoo in 98, 97.
Is that why I don't see people doing it that much anymore? Like,
Monday?
Old-time comedians would go, at the end of this, they'd be, thank you, I've been Lee Side. Right? Like, people don't really do that. And is that why people would do it? So, like, the industry would be like, oh, shit, okay, that's his name?
The Improv did it right. What the Improv did was the host went out.
It's been like 25, 30 years, too,
this
right?
This is 20, yeah. So this is 98, if you got a Triple Crown, shit.
You was good?
That means you did Latino night at the Laugh Factory.
Oh, what do you call it? Hat trick, right?
Hat trick.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you ran over to the Improv and did Freaky Monday.
I don't remember that, but I know the triple.
It was called Freaky Monday.
Why you change your voice when you said that? Like, nobody listening no more. You're like, we got some bitches in the back.
This is secret time.
Okay, awesome.
This is when Uncle Joey Phil's young.
All right, I felt it. You looked me in my eyes when you changed your tone.
What's that white dude that's got the neighborhood?
Mr. Rogers?
Mr. Rogers. I'm like Mr. Rogers.
I feel like he's a pervert for some reason.
He is a pervert, but when he takes you into the lower ranges.
Don't do this to me, man. Like, you hit
the touch. No, I'm not going to. I'm going to talk to you about some perverted shit. But Freaky Monday was very good, very industry strong. The host went up, and then he would put a five-minute act up, black or white, getting his chops. And then the lineup would start at 9:07, 8:07. And it was, you know, a couple of young killers. And then at 8:35, they put on the hottest white dude working. Pablo, Doug Stanhope,
right,
shit like that.
Right.
And then the African-Americans would start, and it would be Bernie,
Can't imagine being in that room, bro.
And I still remember going like six or seven times and going, I'm on to something. And then fucking Stanhope went up one night, and he goes, it's easier to jump over a fire hydrant than it is a nigger. And Chris Tucker was up on stage. And half the room laughed because the joke was funny. He didn't mean it in a racist way.
Right. But
Chris Tucker heard it. And he yells, get that white motherfucker off the stage.
And that was it?
The room went silent. Guess who's going to follow that?
You?
Yes. So I went up there.
That was what they call defining moments, son.
Dog, I went up there to crickets.
Really?
They just turned.
Oh, they couldn't. You represented that crap, that white motherfucker. Yeah, get him out of here.
I went up there and just died a slow death.
Yo, you was like, all right, I'll be back, motherfucker.
And I did come back. I came back like two or three other times. And then it just got too rough. It was too, the booker crazy. Changed and whatever. But those were the nights. If you wanted an agent,
you had to be there.
My first agent was black.
But the thing people don't understand, Joey, this is like what a lot of people don't understand in comedy. Like, it's weird now because you go places, people try to set the list a certain way, and they be talking about, well, he's not going to be able to follow that. And they try to pace the show. But you always got to be ready to have a defining moment. I came up one time, and I think I get my shit off on stage, and I'm back in the main room at the Comedy Store, and you was up. And I was like, God damn, nigga, this motherfucker. Every joke felt like he about to say goodnight. I'm like, oh shit, what you do? You sink or swim? And I was like, fuck that. I just love being in a situation where the motherfuckers are either gonna count you out or they're gonna see what's next and step to that. And there's so many motherfuckers now, they're just so weak when it comes to that shit.
Just talking about the
it's
deal
so
thing.
Weak with it. And it's like, our business is like, Our I won't say competition, but the way we flow, it only brings out the best in a motherfucker.
Yes, it does.
It does. Like, oh, you ain't trying to. I think Neil Brennan said sometime once he was coming behind me. He said, "Oh, we doing closers." I'm like, motherfucker, I'm doing whatever I need to do to fuck this crowd up.
That's it.
That's it.
Your job.
I don't give a fuck if you like, I'm working on this new material. Guess what? I'm going to figure out to work that shit. But my job, when I go up there, is smash that bitch. Whether I'm in, like, you know, I came up from a school of, like, Fat Doctor, old school guy from D.C. He was a mentor to a lot of people. And we talked about working out. People feel like to work out, you got to always just do straight new shit. He's like, man, you get the motherfuckers going, throw that new shit in the middle somewhere. And then do your shit. You know, you ain't got to wear, I'm working. I mean, they do it. Motherfuckers do that. I'm working on this. And I don't know. I'm just like, I feel like that shit got to be in the moment. And just once you get a
groove.
That's
what it is. It's got to be very organic.
It's
got to
be in the moment. It's not what I wrote. I feel like this. It's never what I wrote on the page. It's how I feel. How I feel is going to sell a joke more than anything. You know what I'm saying? You feel fucked up. You got a well-written joke. That shit sound like you're a fucking writer.
Donnell, you got together with Royale, who's a sweetheart of a guy.
Good guy.
I was here for the Royale blow up with the TV show and everything.
Good. All done. Built to last?
Yeah.
When he left me?
He left.
That's when that motherfucker left. You was here? Yo.
I was here. Yo, he was running things. And he got speed.
Man.
He got speed. He was hot.
Yo, man. From my where I came up or whatever, that I'm gonna tell you, Built to Last is a reason why I got the brownstone that he had. He was written a brownstone, right? And it was a dope brownstone. We was broke as a motherfucker, but we had a dope brownstone, and it had an above ground swimming pool in the back of that bitch. The guy who owned the building, he had two brownstones. He split the fence in the middle, opened it up, African dude worked for a bank. He opened up and had above ground swimming pool. That's not exciting to a lot of people. But for fucking Brooklyn, New York, to say you got a pool. And I remember, Roy, you're like, I didn't even talk about it. It was on this side of it. He was popping, bro. Yo, he had a TV show built to last. But you got to be selective on how you name shows, because you can't name a show where a critic can fuck you up. Niggas, they would just say, built to last, won't. You know what I'm saying? It wasn't met with.
Really?
Good, no, but here's the thing. And the way I look at stuff, as much as critical people want to say or didn't last or whatever they felt about it, that motherfucker did something that a lot of people I started with and people I'm still rocking with now have never got to. You haven't got to sit at the big table with motherfuckers saying NBC is like, you ever been in part of an announcement when NBC does their fall lineup and you was on that bitch? And then Angela Bolock, whatever that shit is, Speed, you on some other shit? And I remember, because the motherfucker just left New York. He said, I'm moving. He didn't say shit to me. That motherfucker left, but he left me in a good situation. I just had to find another roommate. But I remember when he took off, and he found a lot of success earlier on his career, which I think has really helped him become a better businessman, a better producer. He does a lot of the hour specials. He has relationships with so many people, relationships with Kevin Hart. I think that getting that much success so early on and seeing how it could fleet, and then not by your design, just how shit happens, what you're going to do now. And I know he went through that from like, it's popping, like, whoa, it's slow, but what can I do now? I'm going to reinvent myself. I'm still going to do stand-up. But like Method Man said, I'm tired of being a chump in the front. I want to be the Mac in the back, you know. But it's so cool that you knew that story, because he was gone. That motherfucker, I could see his wisdom. He was so goddamn happy. You could see wisdom teeth in the back of his fucking mouth, man.
When did Chappelle come into your life?
Chappelle came into my life. He came into my life before I even met him. And the reason why I say that, in D.C., not too many people leave to go to New York or to L.A. That's the hardest thing for a motherfucker to do. They be scared shitless of it. Some people do it and they come back. I'm older than Dave, but Dave is older than me in comedy. So when I first started in D.C., I was, and again, it's not being cocky, I was on fire. You can tell ask anybody. I was literally smoking. I was doing it for 6 months. People thought I was doing it for 3 years. I was the name coming out of D.C. You know, you leave somewhere, what's the name? You go back for Christmas and all that type of shit. You're like, what's the name? And I said, who is, and people used to tell me, yo, you know who getting it? I'm like, who? This young nigga, Dave Chappelle. He a young nigga, right? I'm like, how young? He's like, he's 16 and 17. He getting money, son. I mean, youngin. That's how you say in D.C. He getting money, youngin. He up there, he doing his thing. He fucking with the white boys, the ages and shit. And I used to say, because I thought I was on fire. And I'm saying to myself, fuck, make this motherfucker so funny. It was no competition or anything, right? And then motherfucker looked me in my face and said, he looked me in my face and said, well, he's young, right? Like, I'm an old ass motherfucker. There's like, he's young, he's smart, he's animated. And then this is something that a lot of comics have. They said, one of my friends, Mike Watson, he said, and he act all this shit out. You know what I mean? Like, that means if you're doing that, producers and directors already see you as an actor. You know what I'm saying? You got people to tell a joke. But when they said that, you know, it's like, he act all this stuff out. He good at storytelling. He's everything that embodies a DC comic. So I would ask about him. And he shared this story on my birthday 2 years ago. And Chris Spencer said, how did you meet Donna? He said, and Dave reversed the story. He said, you know, Dave said, I had it popping in New York. I was the man. I used to go home to D.C. and I used to ask, like, who's popping? And then he said, I would always hear the regular names, blah, blah, blah. They said, but they got this one motherfucker named Donnell Rawlins. And Dave said, he was like, man, fuck that nigga, right? Mm-hmm. Because our thing is, like, we've given props, but we don't want to give props. So when I finally moved to New York, I met Dave, because he would come around to the Boston Comedy Club on Black Knight, but he would do mainstream. He did all the clubs. And then it was that relationship we had as being two motherfuckers that was thorough from DC that connected us. It was that. It wasn't like hanging out. It was we met. I think the best way to meet or engage somebody is respecting them. Respect their reputation or what you hear about them. You know what I'm saying? And that's how that was our connection. And this was years before even the birth of Chappelle Show.
So you're cooking, you're in New York, you're making it happen. Any acting classes or anything like that?
I never took an acting class. I don't know if I'm a great actor. I can get past it, but what I would do, I would get monologue books and just practice monologues in the mirror and shit. And this was the weird thing. This goes back to what you said earlier about that 3-year period when all you thinking about is creating, all you like you thinking about your life or your future, like this is it. And I just was just thirsty to do anything. You know, I started a sketch group out of New York before in Living Color. And I started this group because I noticed with my stand-up, it was very three-dimensional. I have characters, my uncle, this fat dude. I was like, wait a minute, man, I could take these jokes and start casting it, casting different people. I could cast somebody to play my mother. I can cast somebody to play Fat Tyrone. So I knew that I was getting opportunities to stand up, but nobody knew me as an actor or anything. I said, but I wanted, what's the next level? What's the next level of this? So I said, I can write these jokes. I can cast these people. I got friends. So I'm going to start this group called Secret Society. And at the time, Red Grant was in the group. Ariane Punter, she was a poet. So I was hitting with the poetry side. Mike Epps was in the group. Good friend of mine, Jimmy Martinez, Rich. Mark Theobald now writes for, The Last Soul G. Sherry Davey, Jason Ondoors. I had like 12 people and nobody, it was the most diverse sketch group in New York. Nobody was doing sketches. And we did a showcase. I told my manager at the time, and his company was just starting. And I was like, man, this is something different. Nobody is doing it. Let's see if we can get a night at Caroline's and showcase the sketches that I do and act them out. So, you know, the industry didn't know exactly what it wanted. So some kind of way, a lot of the industry came out. We did this showcase. And the next day, my manager's phone was ringing off the hook. And, We had 4 agencies that wanted to sign us. I chose to go with APA. At the time, it was the fourth largest film and television. It's by coast, fourth largest film and television agency in the country, and they wanted to sign me and somebody else, and they didn't want to sign the whole group. But because I got there with the group, I said I'm not going to sign with you guys unless you sign the whole group. And it was the first time motherfuckers had casting calls. Where you'll see people names, then you just see Secret Society, like Wu-Tang. Like, you got everybody auditioning, whoever wins, you know? But that was my relationship with New York and trying to do things to get seen and get noticed. I tell people all the time, you gotta be able to, I think in this business, you gotta be able to do what the next man won't do or haven't thought about. It's the only way. And if you don't do that, you're just a regular motherfucker.
You see Dolomite?
I haven't seen it yet. I gotta see it. Everything. I keep hearing about it, and I keep hearing that, and I know the acting was good, but I feel what's resonating is the story of Dolomite, of how he was a maverick, you know, first one to making his own comedy albums, leasing out movie theaters. Did you see it yet?
Yes.
Did you enjoy it?
Very much. Very much. I enjoyed the black experience. You know, I'm a fan of the black experience. I enjoyed, he says something in there that really, it strikes a chord with you, especially when you're an open micer. At what point of your open mic career? He tells Michael Epps, did you ever have anything that nobody wanted when you're trying to sell something that nobody wants? He goes, you know what it feels like, you know? And then, you know, he just broke it. You know, I'm from the 70s.
Right.
And he's like, I got to make movies with what black people like. You know, funny shit, nudity, and kung fu. Black people love kung fu.
He was a Wu-Tang of comedy at the time.
Yeah, he was the Wu-Tang of comedy.
That makes sense, though, man.
you know, and it's just, it touched me in a lot of ways, you know. Like I said, when I came from Cuba, the first family to take me in was an African-American family in the 70s, which is completely different. Afro pics with the hand in it.
Right.
I had a way of...
That was, you was original Different Strokes.
Yeah, I had an Afro pic.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, with the thing. And, you know, I still remember their mentality, and I still remember how on Saturdays the whole building would have a talent contest. You know, and we would do a Soul Train dance, with, you know, way before. And I'm the only white dude.
You killed it? You did it. You did. As long as you stay on beat, you win it. So especially with black people.
They had like a community room in the basement, and you would go down there, and there'd be 100 black families, and you'd have to sing or dance or tap dance. And I still remember me and this kid that I always, his last name was Williams, and I still think about him. We won because we sang Joe Tex, I Gotcha.
Oh, y'all killed it?
Huh?
I know you said it. A question, but did when you had a moment like that, did you think you were going to be in the business of entertainment?
Not even close.
No?
The point I want to make from this story is how they entertained themselves. These people were poor, you know, and then when you went to the house, it was a bologna sandwich, and they gave me half, and the grape Kool-Aid, and they gave me a glass, and... You know, I slept on the floor with the brothers and sisters. Whatever the fuck they got, I got, you know. But the thing that struck me the most about it was the love. Nobody else would like me when I was a little kid.
Yeah.
Except this. And I still remember walking into those projects and there'd be some thugs.
But you had to be a real motherfucker, too,
I was
man.
5 years old.
You was a real 5-year-old. You said, I don't know how to be a real motherfucker at five.
Nothing. I didn't know anything.
They felt something about you, though.
I would walk in there scared, and they would go, you know, what the fuck was his name? Not Torre. And they would yell him, what are we doing with that white motherfucker bringing him in the building?
Right.
And he would go, he ain't white, bitch. He's Cuban. Money.
They like this. He look white, though, right?
And they like scratch their heads. Like, what's a Cuban? Because it was 1960.
Right.
Nobody knew nothing about nothing, you know. But I learned a lot. No, I did not think anything about the entertainment business. It made me fall in love with, they taught me about Archie Bell and the Drells. They taught me about the Supremes. I still remember getting ABC
man,
with
black
them.
People love to love, man.
I loved it. I loved everything about
black
it.
Black people love, you know? Man. Black people love to fuck and love. And black folks, man, we, not the only race, but just because I know it, like our circumstances could be the worst circumstances in the world. But we will figure out a way to laugh, and we will fucking figure out a way to stay off that therapist's couch. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's why they talk about, like, mental health issues or whatever. They always say, well, black people are afraid to get help or whatever. They're afraid to get help. But some motherfuckers don't need to get help. It's just like you got to step your coping mechanisms up. We all go fucking crazy. We all have bad days, but it's how you cope with shit. You know what I'm saying? And then, and another reason, you know, and I'm not speaking for the black community like 100%, but man, motherfuckers are so fucking nerves of pills. You know, when you go talk to that shrink, you leave it with a prescription. You going to get something, son. If you black, the average black person, if you sit down with a motherfucker shrink long enough, he's going to find you a prescription. And a prescription could possibly be trying to cope with shit. I know that mental health shit is real, but how motherfuckers cope? You can't suck nothing up? Everything got a goddamn acronym? You know what I'm saying? Like, oh man, this water's warm. He suffered from PS water syndrome. you know what? Every time he drinks water, he's just crazy. Here's a pill. Black people been through so much. You have to learn how to laugh. You gonna be miserable and upset all the time?
No, and that was what I was getting to. That what I saw in those projects early on in the 70s. Do you know what memories rehashed those memories?
What's that?
The Chappelle Show.
And why so?
I felt that black love again. I felt that humor in your sketches.
Did that resonate through? So the performance of it, like just the connection.
I've known Dave since 94. I know right. Dave since Robin Hood, Men in Tights from the Boston Comedy Club.
Yo, Joey, it's so funny you said that. And this is no shade or anything. And this is about when you finally on the right team or you build the right team. Dave Chappelle probably had 11 pilots.
Yes, he did. A lot of people don't know that.
His company, Pilot Boy.
Yes, he did.
11. He was getting shots and shots and shots.
ABC had him. He stayed. And a white dude had a pilot.
Jim Brewer.
No, another one. One of those big time white dudes.
Yes. I don't know what a big time white dude
is. Like a good looking white dude, like Greg Kinnear.
I'm not sure.
At some point. Ask him. But the point. 98, 97. They kept trying to make Dave a star from early.
Oh, they loved him. He was the one. And, you know, for 11 pilots, we're talking about 11 pilots, and he probably wasn't even doing comedy 11 years at the time. His company named Pilot Boy. And it was this little show, and just, you know, following up what you said is about the love and how you felt. It was something about this show. It was something about the connection Neil Brennan had with Charlie Murphy. It was something about Charlie Murphy. It was something about me. It was something about Anthony Berry. It was something about all of those motherfucking background people that was on that show. It was something that was love, and it felt like motherfuckers was trying. It wasn't about, I'm getting paid this and I need top billing, because wasn't nobody getting paid shit. The only thing motherfuckers was doing was trying to create the funniest shit you could. And for you to say that, that's how it felt, bruh. You know what I'm saying? Like, even when Dave and Neil had reservations about the show, they said, oh, this and that. And I used to predict how the ratings were going to be. I was like, man, this shit about to blow. And they was like, because they've been through it. They dealt with rejection. I don't know that. I'm still like that 3-year nut you talking about. Like, haha. I'm like, man, I'm telling y'all. And the reason why I knew it is this is why I knew it was going to blow. Because I heard niggas in the hood talking about Dave Chappelle. And what I mean by that, Dave Chappelle, when he first started, he came out the gate mainstream. Frat boys loved him. Colleges loved him. Super smart people love him. But I think in the black community, they didn't get him yet. You know? They didn't get him yet. But it was just something about this show. It was like when it started popping in the barbershops, when it started popping on the block and shit like that, that's when I was like, man, this is something special. You know? This is something special. And I was like, because Dave had every audience, but that really, really street shit, it didn't connect yet. Not that you need that, but it's something about Brian Tucker. It was just something about the team that they put together that understood all of that and connected with every part of it. And I think that was one of the things that made that show so dope.
How many seasons?
2.5.
2.5.
Yeah. Seasons. And then, not to take with Dave's, like, it's easy writing for a superstar. And Dave was a superstar. Dave's the type of superstar where you can have shitty writers and he's still going to flip it. You know, so you got that combination. You already had the game. And then you got a team of people to put it together. And that dude was like, you know, we worked together. I remember one particular time we were, it was a scene with Patrice O'Neal. He was playing Pitbull. He was one of the original player haters. It was Rich Voss, me, Dave, and Charlie Murphy, and Yoshi, the Asian dude. And we were working on 16 hours. Man, we was tired. I don't ever think I would ever could say I was joked out. I was joked the fuck out. And we had to look at this board of pictures and shit and just roast them. And nobody, yo, we was looking like this. Patrice was back to gas out. Patrice and Dave been roasting each other all day before we were rolling the cameras. We got the cameras rolling. Everybody gassed out of jokes. It was just pause. It was a picture of Rosie O'Donnell. And Dave said, she looks like she wears drawers with dick holes in the back, right? Yo, you see this laugh, Joey? This laugh was like, oh, where the fuck did he get this from? And that was him all the time. And that the same way we talk about being in comedy clubs, when you go hard and let the shit fall where it fall, that's how it was when we were working on the show. You know, he would do something, and then everybody, the creative would go, and then everybody's like, oh, what about this? What about this? And then shit would just pop, 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 pop. But that motherfucker always came through.
What's the one thing you learned from Dave as a comic?
Really being connected to who you are and your true self. And not just on the stage, just in life. You know what I'm saying? Like, what is your true self and being your true self? And then, like, you know, it's hard to emulate this, but having your calm while you do it. I don't think I ever have ever even seen Dave raise his voice. You know? And just, as I watch him as a performer, and I'll say, like, I say he's like Tom Brady. And when I say that, like, he knows how to lay in the pocket. You know what I mean? He don't scramble like chaotic, like, ah! You know, like me, like I say, I'm like Michael Vickish. I'm saying, fuck that. I'm trying to run that shit down the two-hole. Every time, I know we got a pass play, but I'm going to run this bitch. I'm going to run it. But he's like, when I say Tom Brady, get in the pocket. The calm is there. Wait. And could take a hit at the, boom, and he's scoring a touchdown. You know? And like, he's like Dave's just a good person, man. You're like a good person. You feel that. I travel with him. People always like, even with me, it's unfortunate sometimes because the work I've done on Chappelle's Show easily probably overshadows anything I've ever done. So do I get the credit for being on HBO's The Wire? Do I get the credit for being on The Corner? Do I get the credit of you and I both had that motherfucking gangsta-ass cameo Spider-Man shit? You know what I'm saying? I've done a lot of stuff, but that, for something about that show, is just where everybody connects to that shit.
Very interesting, something you said. I had the honor of working with Dave. What years was the Chappelle Show?
That was like somewhere in around 2002, 2003, yeah.
I had the honor to work with Dave in 99 in Miami. Now, the Miami Improv at the time was in Coconut Grove.
I remember I closed that club down.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not closing down, but I was the last one before. Week. Yeah.
I'm there next week.
And they had some, they got that Cuban rest. You down there? I can't wait to get back.
The new place.
Yeah.
The new place.
And
You're talking about the old one in Coconut Grove.
No, I'm excited about the new one. But I know Coconut Grove, and the reason why I want to say, and I don't mean to cut you off, but that was one of the best places for because they catered to the Cuban. They had that motherfucking Argentinian steak and shit, son. I'm like, this is what the Improv.
That's right, the Argentinian.
Yeah, they had the
fish with the stuffed.
They had a very Cuban influenced menu, so I know you about to have a ball.
And the Italian restaurant downstairs.
Yes, yeah, I remember
that. The fucking frozen drinks.
Then the fucking white chicks walking down a little strip down there too.
Oh,
with the salad bars. I don't think I ever motherfucker was in love with smoothies and shit till I saw the white chicks walking down there with them motherfucking Lemon Lulus and shit.
Lemon Lulus. But Monday and Tuesday at the Miami Improv was African American night, Marvin Dixon.
Uh-huh.
So Marvin Dixon would give away tickets. Now,
with a thong or without a thong? Because he used to pull his clothes off. Yeah, the tickets,
give tickets out on the way out. And not to sound, whatever, it's a different type of brother.
Marvin?
No, the tickets he was giving away were Liberty City motherfucking brothers. You know, they ain't playing.
Right.
And I still remember opening up for Chappelle, and some of those free ticket guys would come up. 3 minutes, they'd walk out on Chappelle.
Really?
The audience had 250 people in it, 100 whites, 100 Latinos, Cubans, and maybe 50 people, 49 knew who Dave Chappelle was. But the ones from Def Jam, Monday and Tuesday.
That's the point I'm saying. Yeah,
they would walk out. They would walk out on Dave. And I'm going, I don't understand this.
Because you was the reason why your mind was like, I say, everybody not ready for everything. You know what I'm saying? That's what I'm saying. It was when the Chappelle Show popped off that the hood started getting a connection. And I'm telling you, I used to be around. He's like, a lot of it, like, motherfuckers in those, like, the real gangster nights, a lot of motherfuckers didn't want to think about their comedy. Dave makes you think about the joke. Dave makes you think about the joke. Dave is not going to be pop, pop, pop. He makes you think about it. He's always been that. He's always been from 17 to 16. He was funny but socially conscious. Your motherfuckers been drinking Hennessy and eating them lemon pepper chicken wings. They don't want to hear about that shit. They don't want a motherfucker to think like that.
And no,
that,
they didn't.
Like I say, there's no shade or whatever. Anybody knows that coming up. But that Chappelle show, that's when it seemed like everything connected for him.
I still remember doing a Tuesday night there. Because Marvin would always hire me.
Right.
I was the feature act. So Marvin would give me $100 a show for Monday and Tuesday, the early, just to take care of me.
Right.
Marvin was a solid little brother.
Yeah.
And I still remember being in there on a Tuesday night, and Chris Rock walking in that motherfucker with Madonna, and Chris Rock was on stage, and them brothers weren't going for it.
Right.
They had forks and spoons, and they would hit the glasses. Ding, 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 ding.
Oh, man, you got to understand this.
That means get the Marvin fuck off.
Yo, you don't understand. Marvin Dixon's rooms and Bruce rooms were, first off, it was...
Where's Bruce at? What was his room?
Bruce's room was in, was it Atlanta? No, Bruce's room was in Florida. One of them motherfucking Southern joints. But they had the two top of Marvin Dixon room. Everybody knew. Because, the reason why, because Marvin never really stabs the room as a comedy room. He stabs it as a spectacle. Like, he used to tout the fact that he had 300 standing ovations in a row. You know how easy it is to get a standing ovation if at the end of the song you drop Don't Stop, Get It, and a man strips down to a motherfucking thong and start dancing? They not laughing with you. They laughing at you. And that's what he established in that room. So I could probably tell you people that ripped that room and people that didn't rip that room. Everybody wasn't fit for that. But those were, I remember Bruce told me one time in his room, he said, look, man, I'm going to give you money now. Like we was doing a drug deal. He said, I'm going to give you money now. Just do your 10 minutes and get the fuck out of here. The door that way. You know, like, those guys, they built a room around their personality so much, it was hard for anybody to do good. And I'm in Miami. Bruce, where was it? Miami? I'm in Bruce's room. And I said something. I said, yeah, all y'all stripper bitches in here. Joe, I did not realize that how respected of a job that was. Like, they looked at me like, we got to get him out of here. He talking about our motherfucking livelihood. And those rooms were just, they was like, those was the fast rooms. If you didn't, like you said, you used to come out and just start fucking them up. I tell people, then when you get, after you've been doing it for a while, you learn. You're like, okay, it's going to be a tough room. This is what I got to do. I got to make an example out of somebody. I'm sorry, sir. I know, no disrespect, but I'm about to tear your ass up, right? I got to do it. And all you get a couple of, oh, no, he didn't. And then next thing you know, bow, they listening.
Now, because of you, I'm going to call in next week and go to D-Ray's room.
Yeah, do it.
Because it's been 10 years. I'm sitting here looking at you going, why is it that, well, at the store, I would always go up. A guy would always just come looking for me and go, we got a 5-minute gap to get in there real quick.
Those rooms are challenge joint. It's like, and like, it's so many reasons. It's so, you could come up with a million reasons why you don't want to go there or whatever. But for me, and you know, like, I work 8 clubs now. You know what I'm saying? I do the store, Laugh Factory. I do everything. I'm a marquee motherfucker. But it's just something in me, every once in a while, I just got to go do it.
When I go to
New York, it's so, and then another thing, I feel like you, like, because of some of the success I've had, when my resume speaks probably more than my bank account does, when I go to, like, when I'm in Brooklyn and I go to these little off spots, the look people give me, they look at me like, fuck you doing here? I'm like,
I'm a comic
and I started here. And for me to go to these little spots, like, they be freaking out. Joey, like, oh shit. I'm like, man, I'm never ever gonna forget what these rooms did for me. These rooms paid my rent. You know what I'm saying? These rooms gave me a place to practice. These rooms was everything to me. And I'm never gonna stop. Never gonna stop. I remember when Dave Chappelle had his residency at the Radio City Music Hall, 6,500 people, like 17 days in a row. Two nights, and I was crushing this shit. Two nights after standing up 6,500 people, I get in the car with my man and drive to Brooklyn to perform for 30 people in Brownsville and gave the motherfuckers the same shit. And to be quite honest, felt better about those 35 motherfuckers that saying, I ain't think, yo, man, get a drink with me. This just, as much as we do this shit, we always got to do something to make our soul feel good. People always tell us, you make me feel good. You know, it's like therapy. I need that. Y'all don't know, motherfucker. Y'all out therapy. It's mine.
It's mine, too.
Man.
I could feel I was fucked up last week.
Why the motherfuckers working at night? I am not working at night. I'm going to see my therapist, motherfucker. And it's you, motherfucker. My friend, Fat Doctor, and his health isn't doing that well. I love this dude. He's a mentor to me, a mentor to Tony Woods, mentor to Martin Lawrence. Really good guys. Very popular in on the D.C. circuit. And he used to tell me, Donnell, that's our life. That's our shit. He said, we deal with regular life. He said, but when we get on that stage, we put that shit on the side of the stage. We do our shit. It don't go away. We pick it back up and we deal with it when we get off. But that's our shit. That's our shit. Yo, John Witherspoon passed. You know, everybody was like, I was just talking to him. Because that's how he worked. That's his life. People are like, we didn't have to. But this is our fuel. What else do we know? Dave asked me one time, he said, when is your tour over? I said, never, nigga. When I'm dead. when I die, they can be like, he just did a spot in the belly room. What else do we do?
I love the fact that if I don't get on stage for 2-3 nights, I go into a different world in my head. I can feel it.
I gotta
get on stage.
Yep.
Like, I couldn't get on stage Tuesday. I couldn't get down there because my leg was still swollen.
Right.
Because I fell the other night. But fucking Wednesday night, I went down and had a blast. The belly room just had a blast because it's who we are.
Right,
I got to do it every couple days.
I couldn't a week or something. I'm like, ugh.
Yeah, no.
I'd be like, what the fuck is going on? Like, and especially, like, right now I'm going through, because I did the degenerate shit.
When did you tape?
I taped about 2 months ago.
When is it there?
December 31st.
Oh, that's it's a good one.
I did that. I did some stuff where I didn't give a lot of my bangers to TV. You know what I'm saying? So now I'm back in the Batcave right now. I don't want to see them faces. You know what I'm saying? I don't want to see that face like.
I heard that motherfucker before. You know, it's a nightmare.
Some people don't give a fuck about that, but I do.
No,
so right
I do.
Now.
I do. So I
get, and now, but you, like, I get off. I watch you do that shit too. I'm like, God damn. But the thing I feel like, I don't know. When I watch you perform, like, you're so strong on who you are on stage. You're so strong with who you are on stage that I feel like a nigga can throw a Lysol bottle up there and you'll catch that bitch and it'll become 20 minutes. You know what I'm saying? Like, everybody don't have that skill set to, you tell a motherfucker go up there and just make something happen. None of that shit. Make something happen. The motherfuckers gonna get so fucking nervous because motherfuckers do not want to trust that what's supposed to make you up there is that you are a funny motherfucker. You're just a funny motherfucker. Some motherfuckers are pen and paper and I don't knock it, but some motherfuckers are just funny. Just like that motherfucker on his worst night, he's shitting on y'all best nights. My leg hurt, nigga. Yo, my leg great. I still fuck y'all up. Yo, I didn't want to sit down. Yo, this leg, but fuck that. I'ma still smoke y'all motherfuckers.
How many years you been doing comedy for now? You going on 30?
20.
Probably, no. Because I'm 29, 28.
I'm trying to backtrack time. Probably like 26, 25?
23.
25. 25. Yep.
How do you feel now? Stronger than you ever felt?
Joey.
And you still wait till the 35-year mark.
Joe,
like I look at Chris and Joe Rogan; those motherfuckers been doing it 30 years.
This is crazy. After 25 years, and I'm not talking about 25 year where it's a slump or he was whacked from 92 to 93. I'm talking about 25 years of being a ripper, and I tell this, I still feel like I get better every year.
Every year.
Every year. Every goddamn show.
You see it. I feel it. I feel it on stage.
And I'm talking about, you know, motherfucker come to you and like, motherfuckers like this, oh shit, yo, that motherfucker funny. You be like, but it's not going to stop. You know, every year, and I'm not, again, I'm talking about every year, I'm talking about off of like last year, I was killing shit. Where people are like, okay, that's it. It's always got to find something else.
Well, we evolve.
Shit happens in life.
I love evolving. I love writing. There's nothing worse than being excited to see a comic and watch them. He does a tremendous set. And all of a sudden, one day you get an email, he's back in town, and you go there, and he does the exact same set. You just lost me forever because you're telling me that in a year, nothing happened.
Nothing happened in your life.
You didn't even take a shit.
Man, the best compliment, the most appreciated compliment I get is when the motherfuckers come up to you and start saying, this is my fifth time seeing you. They ain't coming five times, man, if you ain't flipping it.
Yeah.
If you ain't flipping it, they ain't coming.
Like, I don't even like to go. Like, I got to go to Atlanta in January. I won't go to Nashville
right. In
April. Because half of those Atlanta people are going to drive from Nashville. I already know it.
I got to go to D.C. I do D.C. Thanksgiving weekend. This is the tough, not the tough, this is the...
This weekend coming.
This weekend coming because I that's my hometown. That's like been my traditional show for like the last...
So Friday, Saturday, Sunday, you do the D.C.
Improv. Friday, Saturday, Sunday, yeah. This been my traditional show, you know. But it's so challenging because when motherfuckers that you grew up with start coming to your shows, it's a different level of heckler. I know your mama. You know what I'm saying? Level. And then you start hearing people yell out, today, hey, Darnell! Like, the only way a motherfucker in high school, because you like, oh, you was in gym class with me. And I do that every year. Like right now, I gotta do a remix. We gonna see what happened. You know, we gonna see what happened because this. I was just there. I just did Birchmere a while ago, and then I just exhausted so much. I'm just in that place where once I just gotta get up, something's gotta pop. And then you know, once you get that groove, you just write. You like, damn, that's fucking 20 minutes right there.
It's so crazy how. Right now, in the back of your mind, you're in hell, and you'll be in hell for another month. Then you'll come up with 4 minutes, then something, you know,
right.
Rock does something, this guy does something, now you got 6 minutes, but then you put together a 10-minute run.
Right.
And guess what? You could add three from a joke you had from a year ago.
Yes, when you start putting it together.
Oh!
You like this. And you're ready.
Shit.
You're like, this is... My last set that I had to chop it up for Netflix and do some other stuff. But I was like, man, this is going to be my dope hour. But nobody was coming to me for an hour. They was coming with 15 minutes here, 20 minutes here. I'm like, man, I ain't saving shit. I said, the way I'm going to get an hour is smash it. So, like, even on the Netflix joint, I literally took 45 minutes of shit, trimmed all the fat off,
Oof. And
got straight to a pop, pop, pop.
Ooh.
And I had to sacrifice. It was like, well, you should have set it for your Netflix. But I said, Netflix didn't give me an hour. They gave me 15 minutes.
15 minutes.
And that'll give me the other one. But that, and I had this closing where I had the beginning, the middle. I had a callback. I had a tag. And then my last joke, I had four callbacks. From the entire set. So it was like bop, bop, and at the end, bam, 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 bow. And I dismantled the set. It's going to force me to go harder, though.
So December 31st.
December 31st. And I'm going on tour with Martin, too. I'm doing the Martin Lawrence. This is going to be so nostalgic. Martin Lawrence Lit as Fuck Tour. And he's doing 29 cities. I'm doing like 9 of them. Earthquake, D-Ray, Lil Rail, Jay Farrell, Tommy Davidson. It's a mix of everything, a mix of different people. I got 7 dates. But for me to grow up, like looking at Martin Lawrence, it's like a bucket list shit, man. Just to be able to shake his hand coming on and off stage is going to be dope.
Good for you, man. You got a website where they can find
you? DonnellRollins.com.
DonnellRollins.com.
And Joey, you know I've been coming under I'm glad we had this type of interview. I've been coming under a lot of attack on that I talk too much. And I've heard people saying, I don't know when to shut up and I talk too much. So I've taken that energy and I've started my own podcast so I can talk my motherfucking ass off. It's called The Donnell Rawlings Show. It's be out. You probably can get it right now.
Go Where to you tape it at?
Anywhere. Okay. I'm so bootleg.
All right.
Yo, I want you to check it out. I know you get sick of it, but I'm excited about it.
No, I want to do it with you. I'm going to do it with you next week or the week after.
Yo, it's fun. You're going to love me and Kate. But it's just, I watched it yesterday and I was like, this is different. It just feels so real and so dope. Even our chemistry, you know what I'm saying? Because you see her, when you first see her, you see a pretty face, right? And then you get a couple of minutes, you see a tomboy and just a cool motherfucker.
Yeah, she's a cool motherfucker.
She's cool as shit.
I talk to her every night.
Yeah, she's dope. She speaks so highly of you.
In the morning. Some nights I talk to her at 3. She's like a little
sister. She talked to you so much, I'm like, bitch, I'm not worried about no goddamn Uncle Joey no more.
Yeah, we talk a lot. Her and I are like comedy, you know.
Yeah, you mean a lot in her life. I could tell every time she, your name comes up. Yeah,
no. Listen, man, we also have the mutual friend with the violin, Eliza.
I love that girl.
I love her with all my heart. Guys like you and me, we need edit.
Man, that girl Eliza, when I first, before I moved here, it would be like, I would have to do an audition or something. I didn't know nowhere around. She would come and take me to auditions, damn near living out her car. You know what I'm saying? And I've seen her go up and down in her life. I've never seen her down. I've never seen her frown. I've always known her to be like, it's just part of it. We keep it moving.
I love her Twitter. That's why I put her on the podcast. Love her. I love her to death.
And that violin, she a beast.
Oh, my gosh. Jesus I made Christ. A play. I told her to bring it.
I was like, man. When I talked to her, because she talked to me, right? She was like, I was like, I know you tell you about it. She was like, I want to say, bitch, not the bad way. I was like, bitch, if you don't goddamn take that motherfucking violin and rock that shit.
She fucking rocked.
She killed it, right?
She made me cry.
Yeah.
She made me fucking cry. But, bro, you're always welcome on my podcast.
Thank you. I appreciate it, man.
This is family here. Anytime. No, you kill me at the store, your energy. Same. And I wish you nothing but love, man.
Appreciate it.
And don't forget, I'm in Miami next week, December. New York, December 6th. All that's left is late tickets.
You in New York
for Town Hall, yeah.
Where?
At Town Hall.
I'm a big, gotta go to a birthday party. God damn, I might catch you after, but I'm being in town.
That's all right. I'll be there December 6th, Friday. All the tickets I got left, Boston sold out, so all we got left is the second show for Town Hall, and it's going to be a great show. I got a bunch of motherfuckers showing up, so bring the reefer, do what you need to do. And now for a word from
And that's my birthday, son.
December 6th?
Yeah, I'm fucking with you. I'm sorry. I
How old you going to be?
I don't talk about that shit. I'm still trying to act. Okay. I'm still trying to act.
You don't want them to put you in a category.
I'm still trying to act, man. I be going to audition. I'm like, well, send me out for some teenage shit, man. I'm sick of y'all talking about too old. I'm just going to keep it to myself, but I'm happy.
Now for a word from our sponsors. Who the fuck you think you're dealing with? I want to thank Donnell Rawlings. I want to thank the fucking Christ Killer. But most importantly, I want to thank you guys. First off, listen, the holidays are coming. It's a whole new fucking... Everybody wants to start changing December 31st and they have goals for January 1st. I do it differently. I get ready now. I start getting ready now. You start writing your goals now. You start going on that diet now. Fuck the 31st of December. That's when all the other jerk holes. Right now. And if you want to turn your life around, you're going to start with a fucking bidet. Because why walk around with a stinky, filthy fucking asshole? You don't need that no more. And it's an amazing, unconventional gift that everybody in your life needs because everybody in your life has a stinky fucking asshole, or you have to assume, okay? Everybody deserves the gift of fucking tushy. Wiping your butt with fucking dry toilet paper just removes the shit, but it leaves the other maluki and the stink and the odor. You got poop and all other shit's on all part of your body, and you wipe it off with dry fucking paper. What the fuck are you thinking? Water cleans better than dry paper. Why kill 10,000 trees to wipe that stinky, filthy fucking hole of an asshole you got? Forget about it. It's right now, it's time for you to get a bidet. And if you know somebody, you ever look at somebody and you go, I wonder what their ass smells like. That's the motherfucker that needs a bidet. Go to HelloTushy.com right now. They got bidets starting at $69 motherfucking dollars. You understand? $69. You got different colors. You got guaranteed they got towels to dry your ass. Listen, I know these people personally. I believe in their product. I think they got a 60-day guarantee. It don't matter. If me and Lee haven't cracked it, your fucking skinny ass ain't going to do nothing to it either. Go to HelloTushy.com, press in church, and get 10% off your first order delivered to your house. Like I said, it's the best gift you could give this year, and it's nice and easy. get it delivered right to their fucking houses. If you don't have Hello Tushy in your house and fucking portable bidet, you're slipping. This is the only country where we're still wiping our ass with our fucking hands. Everybody else just presses a button and they clean your balls. They steam dry your asshole. Tushy's making big moves. Go to HelloTushy.com right now and press in church and get 10% off your order. The church is also brought to you by my bookie. Listen, how much longer? How much fucking longer are you going to sit there like a mutage and not make a dollar? Not even a fucking dollar. Really? Really? You can't pick a winner. That's what you're telling me. One fucking game a week. You can't pick? Yes, you can. It starts with my bookie. Look, past, present, and my future. My bookie players, this Thursday, you're going to get a game that's risk-free. Listen, put down the turkey leg and listen. Go to mybookie.ag. If the Pilgrims can sail to America, you could take a chance on a bad Lions game. Either way, you're not going to lose no geeters, all right? For Thanksgiving Day only, this Thursday, choose a team against the spread for up to $250. And if you win, you're going to get some cash for the holidays. If you lose, you also win. Because my bookie will give you your money back. This is Thanksgiving with all the fucking goodies. You understand me? Quit waiting around. Sign up today and get into the fucking game. It's Monday. Sign up today. You can start tonight with Monday Night Football. Carry your winnings to fucking win more money on Thursday on a guaranteed bet. You can't fucking lose. Okay? Let me repeat. That's a guaranteed deposit match and a risk-free bet for Thanksgiving only. So if you're a true fucking football fan, and if you're a true fucking gangster, don't let this opportunity pass you by. Log into mybookie.ag, make your first deposit with promo code CHURCH, and mybookie will match your deposit dollar for dollar from the fucking jump. And that's top of the risk-free bet. Stop waiting in the fucking sidelines. Stop making some real fucking money. I'm going to drive Uber. You ain't going to do dick. This is the fucking path to your fucking risk. And Gamblers Anonymous. 1-800-GAMBLER, 1-800-GAMBLER. But for right now, mybookie.ag, cocksuckers, all right? Use promo code CHURCH. You play, you win, you get paid. I want to thank my bookie. I want to thank HelloTushy.com. And I also want to thank CBD Lion, fucking making lives better. Go to CBDLion.com. Do not forget, Friday, there's just a couple tickets left in fucking New York on December 6th. I'm sorry, there's maybe 20 tickets left. And then Calusa Casino on the 27th of December and the San Francisco Performing Arts Center, something like that, on the 28th. There's a few tickets left up there, too. Knock yourself out. Have a great fucking week. This is the week, motherfuckers. It's Thanksgiving. Gobble, gobble. Kick this fucking Muley.
Gobble, gobble.
Be around to pick up the pieces when somebody breaks your heart. Somebody twice as smart as I. A somebody who will swear to be true as you used to do with me. Who'll leave you to learn that misery loves company. Wait and see. How he does it when he breaks your heart to bits. Let's see if the puzzle fits so fine. And that's when I'll discover that revenge is sweet. As I sit there applauding from a front row seat, when somebody breaks your heart like you.